Please, everybody, help me welcome Joni M. from GSO.
Good evening. My name is Joni. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Wow. Y'all are great. I've been looking forward to coming to this weekend for months, and I have to tell you that you've lifted me up beyond my expectations by your example, your love, and your honesty. Seldom do I go to a meeting of district committee members where there were so many present. And I understand often you have 100%, but the two that were absent had very valid excuses. So I felt like they were there. And I have to tell you, the whole weekend's been wonderful. From the time that Jerry and Francis picked me up at the airport, the plane was early. I mean, really early. They knew that I was wanting to get here. And the drive to Macon and driving around this pretty city and seeing some of the old homes and then coming here and meeting you all, it's just been great. Some of your trusted servants, past and current, I've had the opportunity to know. And the great experience of following their example, not their personalities, that's not what it is, it's the way that they showed me what AA Love and Service is about. And of course, y'all taught me that service is about carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers in whatever form or fashion that I can do that within the 12 traditions. So I feel right at home here, and I thank you very much for your welcome. I told you my name. I told you my problem. I'm an alcoholic. The solution has been given to me through Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of a God that I have come to understand and be in awe of. My home group is the New Garden Group in New York City on West 31st Street between 6th and 7th Avenues. We meet three times a week, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays at 6 p.m. You would be most welcome. The meetings are open, so Al-Anons or the spouses or significant others are also welcome. It's a very good basic group. We tend to attract folks who are in really serious trouble. We get a lot of people from the street. One of our members who was well over 50 years old came to us repeatedly and drank again. Now he has just celebrated 6 years of continuous sobriety, and he has his first full-time job, and he's over 60 years old. I mean, that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. He is an example to me, and I don't believe that, bless his heart, I don't believe he is able to write or to read. But that's what the 12 steps of AA can do for an individual who never held a job of any kind. Now, my own story is a little bit different than that. I was not employable, although, you know, I could read or write. I was brought to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was not my idea. I didn't know where I was going. In fact, by this time, I was in such bad shape that there were many days that I not only didn't know where I was, I didn't care. I had lost all hope. Despair was a part of every day. I had developed a facade of bitterness and cynicism that was real. It took years of sobriety for me to look back in hindsight through the blessing of being sober and working the 12 steps, being sponsored and sponsoring others, to realize how close I came to probably not being able to hear or to cooperate in any way. So I was in pretty bad shape. As a matter of fact, when they took me that day to my first meeting, they were three people who, by the way, were not members of AA at the time. One of them had been, but he felt his case was different, so he periodically drank, but he didn't drink like I did because he was gravely concerned about me. So he and two others broke into my home, which by this time I had burglar bars on the windows like somebody wanted me, you know. I was upstairs in the bed shaking it out. Now, why was I shaking it out? By this time, I had really sort of given up hope that I could ever stop drinking and stay stopped. I'd passed into that state where I was totally powerless to make any kind of decision and stick with it. A totally hopeless state. But I was physically unable to keep anything down, so for a couple of days I'd been upstairs in the bed shaking it out. There was a couple of empty bottles on the floor, and I'm sure all the negative, despairing thoughts were going on in my head. And I heard these voices, and it wasn't the first time I'd heard voices, because I had a lot of hallucinations, you know. But these were real people, and they came upstairs and said, "Come on, Joni, we want you to go with us." Now, when they said that, I thought that I was beginning my last journey away from freedom, because about 9 months before this day, I had signed a commitment paper where I would be placed in a mental institution in Maryland for the rest of my life. My mother and some other family members felt that this was the only hope for me, and I agreed. There was not any problem at all, as far as I was concerned, being locked up, because I didn't think I could ever stop drinking if I weren't locked up. So when they said, "Come go with us," I assumed that's where I was going. I said, "Well, you know, will you help me pack a few things?" They said, "Sure," so they did. And we got in the car and drove. Now, I'm the only one in trouble, okay, because they were not drinking. They had gotten out a bottle of rum and some iced tea. Any of y'all ever drank rum and iced tea? Well, that was my last drink, and they thought I needed it, but yet the driver of the car, stone sober, drove one way down the a one-way street the wrong way. And we ended up at St. Joseph's Hospital, where, thanks be to God, the LaBranche Street group of Alcoholics Anonymous had been renting space for over 20 years, and they were holding a meeting that night. I was taken into the meeting and given a seat. Nobody looked at me as though I were different, but I'm going to try to describe to you what I looked like. My clothes were not clean. My hair had not been washed in I don't know how long. Not because I was necessarily a dirty person. In fact, I was a person who bathed morning and night for years. But by this time, I could not stand in the tub and close my eyes to wash my hair. I'd fall. And if I leaned over the sink to wash my face, or try to take some kind of spit bath, I'd lose my balance then. So I had given up. I had makeup on over makeup. My lipstick, I was shaking so much that my lipstick kind of went up like this and around. And I looked like I felt, empty and lost and dirty. Nobody paid me, or seemed to pay any attention. The meeting got underway. There was a man and woman up at the front of the room, and the woman had red hair. And I could not take my eyes off of her. What she said made sense. She could put two sentences together. She talked about not drinking, and I, you know, inside of me, my cynicism was saying couldn't have had a problem like I've got. And besides, even if I stopped drinking, what about all these other things that are bothering me? But she kept on talking, and the man at the table, Avery, her name was Pat, and his name was Avery, and he talked some, and then she talked some more. And the other people were called on. I didn't know why. I didn't understand what was going on. But they kept talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I could not seem to grasp that this was an AA meeting, particularly in light of the fact that behind their heads, behind Pat and Avery's head, was the blackboard, and it said, "Let go and let God." So I kept thinking, oh, they've taken me to a cult. And then on the other hand, I was hearing Alcoholics Anonymous. The meeting ended, and before they closed, that group closes with the Lord's Prayer. Before they closed, I was aware, not with any smidgen of hope, but I was aware that my insides were not shaking as much as they usually did if I wasn't drinking. And that actually I could have probably sat in that seat for some time longer, beyond the hour of the meeting. I felt not comfortable, but somehow it probably was that I felt at home and couldn't identify with that. At any rate, the meeting ended, and here came all the women with their phone numbers. Now, I don't know about the rest of you gals, but I was not one seeking women's phone numbers. So I thought, what kind of deal is this? You know, we want you to come back. And I tried to start a debate about let go and let God. You know, what does this have to do with anything? They said, we don't care whether you believe that or not. We want you to come back to our meetings. We have 13 meetings a week. I didn't have anything else better to do. And that's the truth. It was not out of any kind of willingness or enthusiasm at all. A couple of the members came and talked to me about the condition I was in, not just the filthy, but that I obviously need to be detoxified. And they suggested that I go into the Alcoholism Rehabilitation Center in this hospital. It was the only one in town at the time. This happened to be October 25th, 1975, which, thanks be to AA and God, is my sobriety date. It was the day of my very last drink. I said, oh, I don't need to go in the hospital. And they said, well, you know, you might have some serious problems. So it turned out I was admitted the next day to the hospital. And coincidentally, a few buildings away, this in the basement, this group rented space. So I made every meeting. I was very fortunate in that I'm allergic to almost all drugs, particularly the kinds that I might have liked, like tranquilizers and painkillers. I mean, they just really make me gravely ill. So I was wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and very, tuned up to everything that was going on in the meetings. I couldn't say anything, because if I tried to, my words got all jumbled. For about 6 or 7 months sober, I couldn't make sense. If I gave you a paragraph about what I was thinking, it didn't go together. But I could sit in the meetings. I began to hear about, you should get a sponsor, Joni. Everybody needs a sponsor. And so I looked for the cute guys, and then they said, well, we're talking about you finding a sober woman that knows something about how to do what you don't know how to do, which is to stay sober one day at a time and to live a useful life. I was not intrigued by that. I But let me just tell you, you see, the things I didn't want to do, like I didn't want to get a sponsor, I finally got up and read the steps, got up close enough where I could see them, and I thought, well, this, you know, this fearless and thorough moral inventory and this sitting down with somebody else, I don't mind telling God or myself, but I'm not going to tell anybody else about all this trash in my past. And I amends so-and-so and so-and-so owe me amends. I don't owe anybody amends. You know, that's the sickness that was in me. Those are the steps that have saved me from myself repeatedly. And sponsorship, particularly my precious Jeannie, who came into my life in my second year, literally have touched my life and turned it around. Not by pushing me, not by forcing me, but by setting an example and walking beside me. If I could tell you what Jeannie did for me, it would light your life in the same way that it has mine and continues to light mine, although she's been gone for 3 years. She's at the big meeting in the sky. She died with 35 years of sobriety. But I didn't know any of that. I knew that I was going to meetings, people were getting up and telling what it was like, what happened, and what they were like now. And, you know, I thought, they don't know anything about drinking. And every once in a while, one of the guys would get up, these old-timers, they were all of about 30 years old, on the back row who'd been sober a long time, and talk, and I could identify. It so happens that I did not know anything about sipping. I didn't know anything about how to do anything moderately. So when my time came to drink alcohol, I drank with both fists and I drank straight. As much as I could, as often as I could. I was later than a lot of you getting into drinking, but I made up for lost time. Not intending to become powerless over alcohol, but figuring if it was good enough to have one drink, let's have 10. And of course, since they were straight, I'd get drunk every time. I didn't begin my life with the intention of joining Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have enough sense to know what AA would do for me and to me. I started out in Houston, Texas, in a really pretty good family. And by the way, early on in my sobriety, I'd have given you a story about my mama this and this happened and that happened and, you know, that's what's wrong with me. All of that evaporated. Through sponsorship and through the 12 steps, I have come to see, 100% believe, that my parents did the best they could under the circumstances, and frankly, they had a pretty nice home for myself, my sister, and brother. The trouble was that I didn't know anything about doing what someone else suggested, especially if my will was in the way. I had this indomitable will that only alcohol could conquer to open my heart to a God of my understanding. So I wasn't a bad kid, but if I made up my mind, look out. There was not a lot of drinking around, in fact, there was little drinking around my home. Every once in a while, we'd have family get-togethers, and the men in the family would get off outside and drink. And they'd laugh and cut up, and I mean, they seemed like they were having a good time, and the women are all in the kitchen, kind of mousy and, you know, grumbling under their breath, and they all looked sour. So I figured whatever the guys were doing was fun. It sure didn't look any fun in the kitchen with the women. But I didn't really associate it too much with alcohol. I didn't have any real experience with it. When I got to high school, I remember having a few sips of beer, and it tasted terrible. So that was the end of it. I was out of high school very young, and by the way, by this time I was already pretty well keeping things to myself. I did not share with anyone except my dearest friend, whose name was Joan also, Joan and I were especially good friends for years until she died suddenly and prematurely, right about the middle of my drinking. At any rate, so I didn't share with anyone. I'm in high school. I did well in school because, you know, I had parents who had pretty good brains, and that had been passed along, thanks to God. But I just did not, I wasn't a part of anything. It looked like I was mixing. It looked like I was, but there was no way that anybody knew what I was thinking or feeling. I would not share that. I didn't. Probably lost the ability somewhere along the way. I went to college and I had two goals. My goals were to have six kids, get married, of course, first, have six kids and be a practice medicine, be a physician. Now, I was hell-bent on doing both of them. Frankly, I loved guys going way back. But the problem was I didn't give them any respect or treat them as human beings. If I saw a cute guy, I'd just do my best to get hold of him and grab him and waltz off into the sunset as far as we could go till either I got tired or he got tired. There was never any, it was nothing was a two-way street. I didn't know anything about how to do that. So by the time I get to college and I'm taking a couple of majors so I can try to sneak around and get a degree in medicine, because my mother didn't think much of it, and I understand why today. I finally latched on to a guy who was really precious. I mean, he had a wonderful personality, and he was very willing to get married, which is what I wanted, so I could launch all these kids that I wanted to have. Now, I don't remember discussing with Bob my goals of practicing medicine or having six kids. The thing was to snare him and get him where he couldn't get loose and then start my projects. I'm making it like it was, folks. Now, I had a cute way of doing this, but I'm still telling you what my motives were, because Jeannie, God love her, taught me what my motives were. I never knew. I glossed them over with all these good things, but my motives were very often selfish and self-centered, great majority of time. Bob and I got married, and the only thing about Bob that I could say that might have caused a problem was he didn't want to work. So he played golf. Really, that was okay with me. It didn't bother me. I was ready to, you know, do all that I could to work and to be busy. I just wanted him around for this purpose that I had, these kids. Shameful, but it's true. The drinking by this time, Bob was a very moderate drinker. When I would drink, and this first came to my attention when he and I were dating and I was trying to get him organized, you know, to get married. I remember going to a fraternity party at his fraternity, and they were going to have mixed drinks, and I had decided that stuff tasted so bad, I had to try to do something to be part of the crowd. So I took Sweeta. Do any of y'all know what Sweeta is? It's a liquid artificial sugar, and I put it in my purse, and I went to the bartender. I said, I want scotch. He said, what do you want it mixed with? I said, just scotch. So he gave me scotch on the rocks. I put Sweeta in it, and it tasted good. And let me tell you, it felt better. So I had several of those. I got drunk and sick at my stomach. So I quit drinking. That was my drinking story off and on for years. I'd embarrass myself or you if you were with me, and I'd quit. It was not a problem. I didn't need alcohol. What I needed was to get all this stuff done that I had laid out without, you know, consulting some of the people involved. But let me just tell you, there was a tremendous blessing out of some of this, and Bob and I had a young son who was born prematurely. His name was Mike. He was quite ill for the first 4 years of his life, but he blossomed into a sterling character, a precious, precious child who was the light of my life. Now, here's this woman who's just obsessed with this child who's not well, and working at Herman Hospital in Houston, Texas, in residency. I had like 2 minutes a week for a husband. So not surprisingly, before Mike was a year old, Bob disappeared. Not literally, but he took off for the golf tour and said he would be back, but he didn't come back. Now, I can remember the realization coming to me that Bob was not coming back. And after that, coming to realize, due to some economic difficulties, we'll leave it at that, that I was going to have to get a divorce. And I remember the darkness that I felt. You see, my ego and myself were so large that I took all of that as though it were my fault. I mean, Bob contributed nothing. This was my fault. And at that time, I remember looking, wishing, hoping for some way to escape this awful feeling. I didn't think of booze. I thought of work and my son, and so that's all I did for the next 10 years. By the way, before I finished my residency, I was taken into the administration of Herman Hospital, which was the largest general hospital in Houston. I was too young to be doing any kind of work like that at the time, but perhaps that was God's way of saving me from myself, because I fell right into it and loved it. There are people that will say, if you come across them today that knew me back then, that there was a lot of good work done. Well, let me tell you about the good work. There were a lot of hours put in. I drove myself very hard and everyone else. And my motive was not pure at all. It wasn't clean. I was working that hard out of my need to be needed, for you to need me, for you to appreciate me. So once again, I didn't know it at the time. I didn't have any of this in my thoughts. But hindsight and step work have shown me what I was about, and that it was not unselfish endeavor at all. I did not drink during this time at all. Eventually, I began to date a gentleman who was a very heavy drinker, and it was easy for me to drink with him. And my drinking increased. I decided that we would get married. Now, let me just say that alcohol was not a problem at this time. I made a decision to marry this gentleman who was significantly older than I was, and to take my young Michael into this situation when I knew that it was not an environment that was good for any child, and probably wasn't anything that I knew much about how to live in, but that's what I did. My selfishness and self-centeredness was such, I wanted this to work. I was going to make it work. I don't know if anybody else in here has ever set their mind on something and tried to make it come to pass, but I was willing to do anything to do it. The drinking, the fact that it was increasing helped a lot to assuage some of the, because I'd have these pangs of guilt about, what are you doing taking this sweetheart, Michael, into this environment where there was a lot of heavy drinking and things that he'd never seen anything like that in his life. But in it we went. I didn't look back. Michael continued, he got into his teenage years, and his mama's drinking's increasing, her working is going on all over the place. For instance, my husband, my new husband, had come into a tire retreading company because his brother had a business failure. And so I took over the tire retreading company. Now, I don't know how to retread tires. I don't know anything about tires. But that was the extent of my self-will. And the more I drank, the more it would light that will. It was as though I was going to control things and make them work out. If only I managed well. That was kind of my theme song. And often I didn't manage well, and I'd have to face the blackness. But I'd look beyond and figure out something else I could do to salvage the situation, which usually was between my husband and myself. The drinking increased. By this time, I was probably drinking very heavily every weekend and some nights. I don't recall an overwhelming need for alcohol, but I recall being ashamed of the amount that I drank. It was a great deal. My son went off to his grandfather and grandmother's ranch for the summer to spend the summer and to do some little work with my granddad, who adored him and was like his father, and had an accident and died, had a freak accident up on the ranch and died. And to show you the strength, or to try to explain to you the strength of what was going on inside of me, I was devastated. I remember that the lights dimmed and stayed that way until I'd been sober over a year in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was determined to go on, to try to go on, to try to... I don't know what I was going to do with this awful pain. I couldn't tell you. It wasn't that I didn't believe in God. It was that I didn't believe God would have anything to do with me, or that I could turn to God. I was a lost person. And now that Mike was gone, all I had was this fiction of this marriage that I kept saying I couldn't live without. This man that I was saying that I loved, when I didn't know anything about love, I just knew about manipulation and trying to get things my way. So there was a lot of despair. I began to drink in mighty portions and very as often as I could, a lot of passing out. That began to be my goal for drinking, which was oblivion in whatever form or fashion that would come. I'd come to and think what a mess I am, and I'd stop for a little while, but I couldn't stay stopped. Alcohol had me. It had gone from being a comfort and a relief, which is the way I identified it for a long time, to having me really by the throat and by the soul. There are a lot of things that I could share a one-to-one with any gal here who feels like maybe what they've done is, you know, beyond the pale. I did a lot of things that, yes, I was ashamed of. I don't carry that shame anymore. I don't carry any of that despair. Why? Because of sobriety and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The things that I was doing back in that period I just mentioned were not something that I would discuss from the podium right now. But I can tell you what they're good for today, and that is to sit down with a gal across the table or alongside of me and share exactly what I did, what happened, what I was like, and that I no longer have any need to do any of that. Nor do I feel the great regret, the terrible shame and remorse that I felt for so long. That's one of the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out towards the end of my marriage, I didn't know it was coming to an end, but I found out what a liar I was. My husband, within a few weeks of my son's death, we had horses we were raising on the place. Horses were sometimes my first love, but usually second to some guy. And he was riding one of the horses, exercising him that morning. The horse fell over on him. He had a crushed chest, which is a very grave injury. And he went to the hospital, and I'm right there, going to be Florence Nightingale, you know, with a suitcase full of wine, by the way. And so about the second or third night, he's really quite ill, and I'm staying the night with him, and he convulsed in the bed. And as I walked towards the bed, now I'd been drinking some wine in the hospital room, but as I walked towards the bed, just clear as anything, I heard in my head the thought, if I don't do anything, maybe he will die. Now, this is a man I said I couldn't live without. This is a man I said I love more than anything. And I'm wishing he'd die. I couldn't get away from that lie, that the truth, actually, that I'd heard that had come to me, which was my thought, not anybody else. I knew it wasn't any hallucination. I wasn't even yet where I'd have that many hallucinations. But I couldn't escape it, and so before too long, I was able pretty easily to let go of that marriage, to get a second divorce, and to move by myself, which didn't affect my drinking other than to increase it. He was not the problem. I was the alcoholic. As far as I know, he hasn't had that kind of a problem, at least that he felt was significant enough to do anything about. I moved alone and drank as much as I could, as often as I could. I would go in and work I was managing several medical practices and dental practices by this time, but mostly I'd go in at night and work maybe 12 hours and then go home and drink. And drink till I couldn't drink anymore, pass out, come to, shake it out, and go again and work, or work a whole weekend and then drink as much as I could. There were a lot of days that I was angry and very sad that I woke up. I did not want to go on. I didn't care. I don't remember all my black thoughts, but I remember thinking, God, if you have any mercy at all, you will let me go. And it was right about that time that the folks came and took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, to the LaBranche Street group. I said the LaBranche Street group saved me from myself more than once, and that's true. Because before I was even really clear of alcohol, my self-will came back. I was pretty well beaten down, and I was quiet, so to speak, for the first few months. But my self-will was kicking and screaming about some of the things they were suggesting. I mentioned sponsorship. I decided that I was going to tell them that, you know, I had tried the best I could. I had been to every meeting they had since they brought me in. I'd been to the other meetings they had suggested, and I couldn't find a sponsor. So that would just have to, I'd have to be exempt. And one of the two or three gals I was telling this to, there was one standing behind me that I hadn't seen. Her name was Pat. She had 7 years of sobriety. She said, "That's all right, honey. I'll be your sponsor." So I had a sponsor. And against my will, she began to help me read the big book. I needed help because I was going to sit there and take it apart, you know, instead of read it. She encouraged me to do my first, fourth, and fifth step, which I thought this was awful. But I did it, I wrote it down, I went and read it as fast as I could, and when I got through, she said, "But honey, what about old so-and-so?" That was my second husband. I said, "We don't have to talk about him. We're divorced. I mean, we've been divorced for years. Why do I have to talk about him?" She said, "You're not through." So I had to go back and finish. When I finished the fifth step, I really didn't know that I was on my way, but I was. By this time, I was celebrating with tremendous awe and great gratitude that I could not vocalize the fact that I was sober 1 year. My first year and year and a half were like a miracle because I was not capable of much other than protest and try to, you know, go around the suggestions. That was like second nature to me. But I wasn't capable of much, but I didn't have a drink. And the hope that began to be born in me was tremendous. By the time I was a year and a half sober, my group elected me to do the coffee, which was a mistake. I don't drink coffee. It doesn't suit me. It makes me kind of sick. So the coffee that I was making tasted terrible. It was either, you know, you couldn't stir it with a stick, it was so thick, or it was too weak. And when they showed me how to fix the coffee, it tasted a little better, but then I had, you know, the cups and the sugar and the cream organized, and when you came up to get your cup, I, you know, fixed the cups again like you messed the cups up. So, I mean, I was such a mess. They let me do that about 3 months, and then they graduated me to literature, which was just, I loved it. I mean, it was tremendous, and I fell in love with AA literature. Doing the literature for this group, which gave away all the pamphlets, of course, and gave big books to every newcomer. Of course, they didn't tell you if they gave you a book, they were going to help you to read it, but that's the way it was. Now, I failed to mention that the reason I was not locked up in the mental institution in Maryland, the reason that commitment paper, which was legal, did not go through was because my dad refused to sign it. He, at the last, when they asked him to sign, which he was really the one with the power to get this done, to commit me for the rest of my life, he refused. And he's the one that then encouraged me to go into the hospital to be detoxified. Now, my dad and I had a fantastic relationship up to the time that alcohol took first place in my life. And, of course, he was seriously disappointed and gravely worried about his daughter that he loved very much. When I was approaching 2 years of sobriety, there were several things that happened in my life. And the first one was that I had a sudden illness that was really pretty grave. I was hospitalized for 8 months. Couldn't move a lot, and frankly couldn't lift my arms. And I came out of that because of God's grace and because of AA people hanging around, and I came out of it with enormous faith. The faith which had been lacking that would stand me in good stead and help me go through anything 1 minute at a time, 1 hour at a time. Unafraid. I haven't had any fear that I know of since that time. I returned to AA. It took me another couple of years to get where I could walk and walk straight and didn't look like I'd just been on a good drunk, but my friends knew that that was not the case. And about this time, I began to get calls of concern about my father, who I told you I love very much. And Dad had been in despair ever since my son had been killed. They had been supremely close, and Dad had begun to drink more and more. And a couple of the people at his office, he was the managing partner of a large law firm, a couple of the folks were very concerned about him. So I decided, I set up a little thing whereby I was going to go talk to him about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, Dad was extremely grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. He would talk about AA when he went and talked to the American College of Trial Lawyers or to the American Bar. He was happy to do that, but he didn't identify it as something he needed. So I get a new big book, and I'm arranged to see my dad alone at home. I asked my mother to be gone, and I approached my father and said that I thought he might have my problem, and I wanted to give him a big book. Now, Dad, I'm telling you, he loved me as much as anybody ever has in my life, with the possible exception of my son, but he was angry. He said, "What do you mean, talking to me about your drinking? Just because you're in AA, you want to get everybody in AA?" I gave him the big book, and that was in May. My father did not have a drink after that until he died 6 years later. He was still not drinking. He was mad at me for quite some time after I left his home. In fact, he wouldn't speak to me. He'd write me these notes, you know. I don't know if you ever got notes from your dad who loves you, but it's really hacked off. Gradually, that was overcome, and he began to refer to the two of us as the two alcoholics in the family. When my precious father died, I was asked to go to his office and to help pack the papers, which were bequeathed to a college, a university where he had graduated from the law school. And I walked into the office and sat down reluctantly at his desk and began to work on what was there. And I opened the drawer, and there was the big book. It was used. Now, I don't think my dad ever made an AA meeting for himself. As far as I know, he didn't. But he got from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous what he needed to not drink one day at a time. And he did whatever he thought he could to abide by the principles of AA. He just didn't feel that his situation was where he could, at the time, attend meetings. And so that's just another reason I'm grateful to AA. About this same time, Jeannie came into my life. I had been attending a big book study because it was suggested, not because it was my idea. By this time, I began to do what was suggested, you know, because I didn't want to drink. I mean, I seriously was dedicated to being sober. I never thought any of this stuff would work. The steps. In fact, I tried to tread water after that first fifth step, and I was forced into six and seven because I was driving myself nuts, you know, with my character defects. Again, it wasn't because I thought I should do it. I did it so I wouldn't drink. But I went to this big book study, and up the stairs one night came this wonderful-looking, red-headed woman, sober a very long time. And she sat down. I knew that I wanted what she had. Pat, my sponsor, was getting ready to move away, and I was feeling pretty anxious about that. I wouldn't admit it, of course, but I was. And I began to draw close to Jeannie, and then I asked her to be my sponsor. Now, Jeannie never said for sure that she really would rather have not sponsored me, but I think her first reaction was one of horror. I mean, it was pretty obvious that you've never been horrified. I have a couple of times because I attract gals. The ones that ask me to walk with them are just like me. I mean, they got all kinds of ways to go around the corner and not do it AA's way or the way of experience. So I don't get any of these easy ones. But anyway, Jeannie put her arm around me and said, "Honey, you come over and we'll talk about it, but don't come without your big book." And she meant it, because that was the reference manual for living, as far as she was concerned. Not just to work the steps, but she could find an answer to anything there. She had enormous faith and great ability to communicate with the woman. Jeannie's background was different than mine, but her love for me and for any woman who wanted to stop drinking was so enormous that I never felt any differences between us. We were not friends initially. I simply followed around and did what she said, and more willingly, because her example was so huge, so terrific, that I wanted more. And that was the place I knew to get it. I had gotten very involved in general service against my will. The group elected me. I think they did that because the previous GSR had asked for funds to go to the regional forum, and I voted against it. I said, "The idea of giving that man $200 to go to Albuquerque, it's ridiculous." So they just patted me and, you know, didn't pay any attention. They sent him on. But they elected me GSR, and I began to go to area assembly. It wasn't always comfortable for me. I don't know if you've been totally comfortable in every area assembly, but I frequently knew that I could do it better than they could. It's not easy to tell you, but I'm telling you my thoughts, my motives, which are not pure unless I am following the 12 steps. Today, I'm on to my motives and just like that, and I know when I'm off track, and I know where to turn and what to do. But back then, I was just kind of subject to self-will still. But frankly, being involved in general service showed me another dimension. What it showed me was that sacrifice of self for the common good or our common welfare was the heart of service. Whether that meant getting in a car and driving 6 hours to call on some wet drunk with another alcoholic, or whether it meant letting go of my will to abide by the group conscience with a smile and to support whatever the group conscience had decided, I began to see the value of that, what it could do to my life, possibly what I might be able to give others. Now, I'd already been, you know, decided that sponsorship was the road to glory. And early on, I had been involved with some gals who had asked me to sponsor them. They didn't stay sober, and I don't take any blame or credit for that. However, I was very disappointed. Then along came a gal named Jerry, who was the first gal I sponsored for any length of time, who didn't stay sober at all for 5 years. And then one day she stopped drinking, and one day at a time stayed stopped. What Jerry and I went through together along her road of eventual sobriety literally turned my life around again. I mean, I began to love a gal that I couldn't stand, if that makes any sense. I really loved her, and I was at her first anniversary, her first birthday, I was beside myself with joy. I mean, she was the one with the 1 year, but that was, I'd learned to care about somebody else and to celebrate their joy. I knew the credit wasn't mine by this time. I stayed involved in the area. You haven't heard a thing about men, so I want to be sure before I sit down to tell you about a man who is, and not the only man, that's been very significant in AA. There have been a lot of people whose example has shown me a door that I could walk through. One of them sitting up here, Joe P. His example has been magnificent in my life. There have been others, but there was a special man in Houston. He was one of the old-timers in my group, although he was relatively young. He had come in at age 20. When I arrived, he had 19 years of sobriety, and Ken ignored me. He didn't have anything to do with the new gals, and about almost my third year, Ken started saying, "Hello, Joni, how are you?" And he'd smile at me, and I thought, oh my goodness, he's cute. And maybe I can get this program by osmosis if I can just snare him. I won't have to do all this work. That's what happens when you think like I do. At any rate, I began to make eyes and do whatever else we do. You know, I don't need to describe it to you. And so after a few weeks, Ken would drive me home from the meetings. He held my hand. I thought, oh, we're practically there. And what happened was one night Ken said he would like to come in my house. You know what I thought. And he sat me down. And he said, "Joni, I need to talk to you." I said, "Good, wonderful." He said, I want you to know that I really love you, but I'm not in love with you, and I don't intend to marry you, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me some principles that don't allow me to take advantage of you." And I started protesting, "You won't be taking advantage of me." He said, "Nevertheless, there won't be any of this light housekeeping or playing footsie." I thought, you know, I'll change his mind. This is definitely not going to last. But it did. Ken and I, gradually, against my will again, became best friends. I mean, super close. Jeannie and her husband Jim and Ken and I went everywhere. We 12-stepped all over Southeast Texas. Ken was already sponsoring a huge number of guys, but never did I get what I had wanted. Instead, I got a gift of a magnificent friendship and example. I mean, this man was, as far as I know, he never was involved in general service, but he was very involved in carrying the message however and whenever that he could. Within a few years, Ken became gravely ill, suddenly, and he came to my home one night, and I looked in his eyes. He had lost the ability to speak in a meeting when he was speaking, and I realized he had a significant problem. He was admitted to the hospital, and Ken lived in between surgeries for 5 more years. Most of that time, he was bedridden, he couldn't speak, and couldn't move. His example in those 5 years was really no different than it had been in the previous 22 years. It was extremely wonderful. The guys that he sponsored continued to come. When his money ran out, the hospital bills and doctor bills were huge, because he would be hospitalized like 13, 14 months at a time. When his money ran out, a lady who was a nurse, so happened that she was the gal that I was walking with, I sponsored, and I took care of him for the rest of his life until May of 89 when he died. Now, so you are aware that when I say we took care of him, that this was not an act of total kindness. One day at a time, I was willing to do that in order to give back to a man who had been of enormous benefit to the home group that saved me from myself. There were times, weekends, I'd want to go to this AA conference, it'd be my time to stay with Ken, that I'd get about half a resentment, thinking, why can't I go off and meet some cute new guy? But I would stay out of gratitude that sometimes I didn't even feel. And by the time the weekend was over, I was enormously grateful that I had. Those are the kind of gifts I've been given. My genie and I became extremely close friends in the last few years of her life. I watched her, a woman who could talk about surrender and just about convince anyone that it was the way to go, to stay sober one day at a time and to achieve the inside benefits, as she called them. I watched her surrender finally. She wanted to live, she wanted to go on, but I watched her surrender to a God of her understanding. I was at her bedside when she died. And yes, I miss her terribly. I have another sponsor named Ann B. But I will tell you, there'll never be another Jeannie. When Ann's talking to me, I still hear Jeannie, and yet I get the benefit of what Ann's saying also. I'm so grateful to be able to pass along Jeannie's example of love and service to gals that I sponsor today. I'm very involved with step work with each gal that asks me to walk with them, and we get together, several of us, at least once a month, usually twice a month, to read the big book and work the steps as we come to them. And of course I work the steps because I need it at least as badly as they do. Shortly after Ken died in May of 89, I got a call. I had previously been interviewed for a position at the General Service Office, and I didn't feel I could do it, and I think they knew that it wasn't I wasn't ready, or it wasn't my time, because Ken was still very ill and I felt an obligation, and I think they had some better candidates anyway. So I had turned that over, but I got a call from the general manager to please come up, that they needed some help, and so up I went, and I was offered a job at the General Service Office, which I was thrilled about. I was not thrilled about going to New York City, and I got to tell you, it's still not my favorite place. But it's where the office is, it's where my work is, so I'm comfortable living there for now. The General Service Office and the work there is a job. The benefits are being in touch with folks like you, sharing experience, strength, and hope, listening to you, because often that's where I learn. Doing whatever I possibly can to be helpful, to try to fit what Jeannie used to tell me was my purpose, to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. Now, you know, for someone to come along to that point and not be bedeviled with this ambition and this self-will and driven crazy is really a miracle, I think. In fact, I expect that I'll continue whatever road or roads in AA that I can, that are directed to me, hopefully by a higher power, with the guidance of a sponsor. And when my time comes to go to join my son and Jeannie and others in another place, I hope that... I really only have one hope, I think, and that is that there'll be one gal somewhere who say, that person, Joni, showed me to the door of AA, helped me to get inside, and one day at a time to find out how to not drink and to live a useful life. That's what you've given me. That's really all that I have to offer. Again, I am supremely grateful to be here. Joycey, thank you for an enormous gift. Thank you.